The focus of this negotiation was not on the trade agreement, but on getting Trump to meet with Xi Jinping again.
Talk is what's traded the most between China and the United States. It's Monday, February 4th. This is VOA Asia. Hello and welcome. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Find us on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, a large waste facility is built for Rohingya. We meet a Uyghur woman who's found new life in the United States. Coral reef dangers, a possible Ebola vaccine, and brewing coffee in Seattle. It's all on today's VOA Asia. The most recent round of trade talks between the United States and China concluded in Washington last week with no firm deal other than a commitment to keep talking. Nike Ching reports on the status of the talks between the world's leading economies as they tried to find common ground before American tariffs come online in early March.
The U.S. Mint is releasing lucky money for 2019, the Chinese Year of the Pig, a sign of prosperity and good fortune. As for weather, the two countries are also on a path of prosperity. U.S. President Donald Trump sounds optimistic.
We had an incredible meeting yesterday with the Vice Premier of China, a very powerful man, highly respected, very strong, very respected also by the President, President Xi. And we had an amazing meeting on trade, mostly on trade, actually also on fentanyl. China's agreed to criminalize fentanyl. That's going to have a huge impact on fentanyl coming into the country.
American farmers also feeling upbeat, says Adam Nelson, director of national legislation for the Illinois Farm Bureau.
We have lost sales. And, you know, I think the longer it goes, the more likely it is for these countries to come up with new supply chains. You know, that's the fear.
Author and political commentator Po Kongchen said the positive reception is the result of a calculated decision by China to focus on appealing directly to President Trump.
Liu He sent Xi Jinping a New Year's gift this time. The focus of this negotiation was not on the trade agreement, but on getting Trump to meet with Xi Jinping again. The most important thing for China is to save face for Xi Jinping and to let him have something to show domestically.
In Washington, lawmakers like Senator Marco Rubio praised China's purchase of more U.S. agricultural products, but said more work needs to be done. One of the biggest concerns is technology theft.
China is a great power, is going to continue to be a great nation. It's not about containing China, but there needs to be equilibrium in our relationship. And it cannot be that they can do anything they want here, but they restrict everything we want to do, and it cannot be that they steal the things we innovate and then use that to put our companies out of business.
Tough words from U.S. lawmakers while the negotiating teams continue to meet. The Washington talks had a muted reaction in Beijing, where officials said the next round of dialogue will continue next month in China. Nike Chin, VOA News, State Department.
These are among some of the top Asia stories that you'll find right now when you go to voanews.com. The United States and South Korean diplomats meet ahead of Trump-Kim summit. Philippine troops battle Muslim militants after church blast. Australia says last child refugees to leave Nauru camp. End of an era. China-Silicon Valley relationship chills. China greets Lunar New Year with celebrations and travel rush. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and much more when you go to Facebook at VOA Asia. Also stop by the voanews.com website. VOA Asia continues. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Australian mining giants Rio Tinto and BHP are supporting greater Indigenous recognition in Parliament. BHP Chief Executive Andrew McKenzie said the company, like the nation as a whole, has unfinished business with the indigenous peoples of Australia and that it cannot stand on the sidelines. Critics, however, believe it could be a cynical move by the mining sector to gain favor with tribal groups which have lands rich in natural resources. We have more from Phil Mercer in Sydney.
BHP and Rio Tinto are supporting a campaign to change Australia's constitution to give a formal voice to Aboriginal people in federal parliament. The mining giants employ thousands of indigenous workers and are backing a demand from community leaders called the Uluru Statement from the Heart, made in 2017, for a special Aboriginal body to advise Parliament. BHP Chief Executive Officer Andrew McKenzie said the reform would empower Indigenous people and would boost the reconciliation process.
We now have a chance to create a new chapter in our history, to create a voice that will establish a bridge across that gulf. Now, I know there are fears that a constitutionally enshrined voice, confirmed by referendum, will deepen cultural divisions and is undemocratic. I don't think those fears stand up to scrutiny.
BHP will contribute about $700,000 to a project raising awareness about the benefits of an Indigenous voice to the Australian Parliament. Many of the company's operations are located on or close to Indigenous land. BHP says it acknowledges the right of First Australians to maintain their culture, identity, traditions and customs. But there is scepticism about the company's motives. Jacinta Price, an Aboriginal councillor in the central Australian city of Alice Springs, believes the miners' support for constitutional reform is a superficial move.
We need to have a bit more of a discussion. I don't know that just simply throwing your support behind something that we're not sure what that actually looks like is helpful. And in a way, perhaps it is a way of these companies to look better in the eyes of Indigenous people, considering it's Indigenous people's land that, you know, they want to be involved in.
Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison has rejected the mining giant's push for greater Indigenous rights in federal parliament. He said he was focused on practical measures to help Aboriginal communities. Indigenous people make up about 3% of the population, but suffer high rates of poverty, ill health and imprisonment. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
The biggest waste facility ever built in a refugee settlement has begun operating in Cox's Bazar, Bangladesh. That's home to nearly 1 million Rohingya refugees. The UN Refugee Agency, which is funding the project, reports the treatment plant can process human waste of 150,000 people every day. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from UNHCR headquarters in Geneva.
More than 750,000 Rohingya refugees have fled to Cox's Bazar since August 2017 to escape persecution and violence by Myanmar's military in northern Rakhine State. Thousands of other Rohingya have fled to Bangladesh during previous periods of repression in Myanmar. This huge population generates an enormous amount of human waste in the congested settlements where limited land is available suitable for latrine pits and wastewater treatment. UN refugee spokesman Andre Mahechich says managing the waste in this terrain requires an innovative approach. He calls the new waste treatment facility a major step toward resolving this problem.
The ability to treat large volumes of waste on site rather than having to transport it elsewhere is a critical step to safe and sustainable disposal of such waste in emergency situations. This will significantly reduce health risks for refugees and host communities alike and the likelihood of outbreak of diseases.
For example, he notes more than 200,000 cases of acute diarrhea were reported in the Rohingya camps last year. In addition, he says people are suffering from respiratory infections and skin diseases like scabies as a result of the unhygienic conditions. Mahechik tells VOA UNHCR plans to roll out similar treatment facilities at other sites to ultimately deal with all of the waste being produced on a daily basis.
The point of this is also that the end result is safe, that there'll be also biogas production as part of that, and it will be whatever remains is made neutral in such a way that in no way can damage human health.
Mahechich says Bangladeshi authorities have provided the site for the waste facility. He says engineers from UNHCR and the British charity Oxfam, with support from Rohingya refugees, built the new site in just over 7 months. He says the initial cost of developing the site, installing the equipment, operating and maintaining the facility, is just under $400,000. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Happening now in Asia, Lunar New Year is Tuesday, and China is greeting it with celebrations and a travel rush that will see an estimated 3 billion trips by people around the country. Thousands of passengers are toting bundles of clothes and gifts at Beijing train stations as they return to their hometowns to reunite with family and friends. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're glad to have you with us as we both start out a brand new week right here on VOA Asia. The greatest concentration of Muslims in China is in Xinjiang province, where some 10 million Uyghurs live. Repressed by the Chinese government, more than 1 million Uyghurs are estimated to be held in detention camps, according to a United Nations report. Beijing calls these detention centers re-education camps and denies any human rights violations are being committed. But accounts of violations persist, including one from a Uyghur woman who underwent a harrowing journey from a detention camp to the United States. VOA's Sabah Shah Khan has her story.
This woman lives with her children in Fairfax, Virginia, a suburb of Washington, D.C., thousands of kilometers away from where she once faced one of two fates: death or life imprisonment.
I never thought I could come to the U.S. I thought if I could get to Egypt, I would at least be safe there.
Born into a Uyghur Muslim family in Xinjiang province, Mehergul Tursun had dreams. She modeled for TV ads and then joined a Chinese export firm which allowed her to travel to many Muslim countries. She eventually left that job to join a university in Egypt, got married, and had triplets. Her problems started when she returned home in 2015 to visit her mother.
I was at the Urumqi airport. They separated me from my three children. They placed tape over my mouth and a bag over my head. They handcuffed me, and then they transported me over to the detention camp.
The United Nations reports Muslims are forced to renounce their faith in these re-education camps. Chinese authorities deny this. Marigol claims that she was tortured by Chinese authorities because they believed she was a spy, and also because she refused to renounce her Islamic faith.
During this torture, when it got really intense, I couldn't stop myself. I said, Ya Allah. Then they knew.
It wasn't just physical torture, but mental too.
They talked to me, yesterday your mother died. And your father died, and your brother, sister, and in the prison now, forever cannot go outside. And your son, his head broken, die, and your daughter in the hospital maybe die near. So you will die also.
She realized if she died, what would happen to her children? So she told Chinese authorities children were Egyptian nationals, and if they were harmed, it would cause a major diplomatic incident. Once Chinese authorities established her children's nationalities, they wanted them out of the country. But the Egyptian embassy demanded to meet the mother. When Marigold did finally meet Egyptian officials, she told them she was also an Egyptian national. And that led to her release from detention and her eventual journey to the United States.
When I was in detention, there were a lot of women who had desires and dreams, and they'd talk about what they would do if they ever left. And I told myself that now that I am out and before I die, I would be their voice. I'll make sure that they are heard.
And she is doing just that. Recently, Marigold met with U.S. lawmakers to share her story and ask for their support to help the Uyghur Muslims. Sabah Shah Khan, VOA News, Fairfax, Virginia.
Coming up, saving reefs in the Indian Ocean. You're listening to VOA Asia. The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English. This news alert from VOA Asia: once-in-a-century flooding in part of the eastern Australian state of Queensland looks to worsen as the nation's weather bureau warned of more heavy rain in the area. Some residents have been evacuated after days of monsoon rains lashed the region around the coastal city of Townsville in North Queensland. Visit VOA Asia Facebook each day for more. This is VOA Asia. Now, as VOA Asia continues, one of the most important aspects of gauging the damage done to the world's ecosystems by climate change is knowing the current status of those systems. So a Britain-based charity is about to embark on an expedition to gauge the health of one of the world's few remaining pristine coral reefs. We dive in with VOA's Kevin Enix.
According to the nonprofit Coral Guardian, coral reefs host about 25% of all the ocean's biodiversity. They also serve as a natural barrier to protect shorelines from punishing storms and waves. But we're losing them.
We've seen mass coral bleaching taking place with an increasing frequency and increasing severity. We're seeing all sorts of other impacts on marine life, and that's now. If we allowed the temperature to rise to 2 degrees, then we can pretty much wave goodbye to coral reef ecosystems. And indeed, we will probably lose many other types of marine habitat and many species as well.
Experts say the problem is warming waters, due in part to human activities that contribute to overall climate change.
We've seen a global movement of marine life in order to try and track the temperatures that organisms like to live in. They're moving to the north or to the south, away from the equator.
To better understand what's happening to our reefs, the British nonprofit Necton is about to head to the Seychelles, off the coast of Africa, to assess these mostly healthy reefs. The team will make a series of dives on board the submersible to better understand what's going on in these reefs.
It's really vital that we go literally out there and see, for example, how our coral reefs are affected by all these CO2 emissions, and which causes acidification and essentially causes the destruction of coral reefs.
The mission will allow the team to understand not only shallow reefs, but also the deeper reefs that are still something of a mystery.
So it would be really interesting to go out there and actually see, in Seychelles in particular, which is one of the places which is relatively pristine still, to see if the effects of climate change are actually evident on the shallow coral reefs, and especially on the deeper reefs that so far no one looked before.
Alex Rogers, an Oxford professor working with Necton, says the information is vital, because saving the coral reefs and combating climate change is something the world has to tackle.
We have to make a decision whether we go down a pathway of behaving responsibly, or we can continue on the pathway which we're currently on, in which case we're going to see probably a geological scale extinction in the ocean. And it's as simple as that.
The 7-week expedition begins in March. Kevin Enix, VOA News.
This news from VOA Asia: two Australian mining giants are supporting greater Indigenous recognition in Parliament with a change to Australia's constitution. Critics believe it could be a cynical move by the mining sector to gain favor with tribal groups which have lands rich in natural resources. You'll find all the big stories throughout the day on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Now in VOA Asia, more than 700 people have been sickened with the Ebola disease in Democratic Republic of Congo, and of those, more than 400 have died. The neighboring countries of South Sudan and Rwanda are bracing for the virus to spread, but half a world away, U.S. researchers are racing to develop a new long-lasting vaccine against the virus. VOA's Carol Pearson joins us with some hopeful news.
In Congo, Ebola claims the lives of 60% of those who get the virus. The disease is so devastating, even those who survive it are shunned.
Really makes it frightening is the high mortality rate, the very severe symptoms that people experience, and, you know, the fact that it comes up when not expected.
The death rate is high even after a vaccine was used in West Africa during an Ebola outbreak that claimed 11,000 lives. Dr. Paul Spearman is leading a U.S. team of investigators to develop better and longer-lasting vaccines. Researchers are conducting a clinical trial that's testing two experimental Ebola vaccines.
We're giving one vaccine and followed 1 week later by another vaccine. And that could give you very rapid protection.
If the vaccine combination proves effective, it could be used in African countries where Ebola breaks out regularly.
These epidemics that occur in several parts of Africa can arise without warning.
The vaccines don't contain the Ebola virus, but they produce a major Ebola virus protein that's designed to get the immune system to react. Study participants are well aware of the health and humanitarian crisis Ebola causes.
Anything that we can do with research, through research, to stop it or prevent it or make it so that it's not something that grows rapidly or spreads rapidly, then I think being a part of something like that is worth it.
To see if these vaccines work, researchers test the volunteers' blood samples, which are collected before getting injected with the experimental vaccine, and also afterwards.
We have baseline after 1 week, after 2 weeks, and we compare the three and then see what difference vaccination makes.
The researchers hope their work could provide clues for other Ebola vaccines, as well as a better understanding of how to build immunity to other pathogens, which are viruses, bacteria, or other bugs that can cause disease. Carol Pearson, VOA News, Washington.
The very first Starbucks coffee shop opened in Seattle, Washington in 1971, and it grew into what is perhaps the world's best-known American coffee company. But in Seattle, it's not the only brew in town. And as Natasha Moskovoya discovered, locals never lost their love and appreciation for an individual approach and experimentation, and small coffee bars mushroomed in the city. Anna Rice shares her report.
Making a cup of coffee at a so-called slow bar takes between 5 and 15 minutes. One of the oldest methods of brewing coffee uses a vacuum pot. A vacuum coffee maker operates as a siphon, where heating and cooling the lower vessel changes the vapor pressure of water, first pushing the water up into the upper vessel, then allowing the water to fall back down into the lower vessel.
And then in the end, it ends up being a really clean cup of coffee. We use two filters, so it makes a cup with a lot of clarity. There's no oils or sediment, so it should have a really sweet finish and also a nice acidity to it, similar to like what you'd find in fruit.
A slow coffee might cost you $12. But here, it's not a luxury. It's a way of life.
I'm not really sure. It might just be because, like, 9 months out of the year, it's raining and dark, so that you need something to pick you up. Otherwise, you're just tired all the time. I drink a lot of coffee, yeah. Maybe, like, 4 cups a day, 5 cups a day.
A thoughtful approach to coffee brings interesting new players to the industry. For instance, the owners of this place, a historian and an anthropologist, decided to open the coffee shop after finishing their PhD degrees. Pipo Bui thinks the days of bad coffee stereotype in the United States are numbered, and soon the habit of grabbing a paper cup and drinking coffee on the go without giving a second thought to its origin will be forgotten.
I think that more and more of the United States citizens, when they can afford it, are looking to invest their money in places that align with their values.
To help cultivate the new coffee culture, Boy and her husband decided to, among other things, send all their baristas to small farms in South America to see for themselves how coffee is grown and collected and learn to experiment with the beans. Many coffee shop owners in Seattle agree with Bui. For them, the coffee revolution that is brewing in the area is well worth the results. For Natasha Moskovaya and Alexander Bergen in Seattle, Washington, Anna Rice, VOA News.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. You'll find us online at iTunes and SoundCloud. You can download us as a podcast and listen to VOA Asia wherever you go. You can also find all of our programs, all the full-length programs, on our website. That's voanews.com. So if you missed something or you want to go back and listen to something, that's the place to go. You can also join us on VOA Asia Facebook, too. We'd also like to thank everybody listening on the radio, Star Radio FM 88.3 at Chungrung Christian University in Tainan, Taiwan. Thanks to everyone there who's tuned in. And our thanks go to Director Tracy Carter, Engineer Aiden Utku, Managing Editor Diane Gao, our VOA Asia team, Skylar Ogden, Ira Melman, Doug Bernard, Keith Lane, and Anna Cook. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. Have a great day.